We've heard so much about music today, and the children's sermon was so wonderful, and I want to conserve the time we have together, so I'm going to try to hit the high points of what I want to tell you today. Music is very powerful. I think we all sense that. I think we see it in our lives. I was just talking to a friend who had been living in New York during 9/11, and he was a musician. He said, you know, I sat down at the piano that morning and to practice, as I always do, and I didn't see any point in it. I wondered if I should ever play music again. This was just so shattering. And he said, but you know, I started to hear in the streets, people were singing, "We Shall Overcome." People singing "America the Beautiful." So I realized I shouldn't stop the music. The music was already healing the people. It's really amazing. One of my favorite pieces, it's by a composer named Olivier Messiaen, and it's called The Quartet for the End of Time. He was incarcerated in a German prison camp, and he found a guard that would give him some paper and a place to compose. And there were some other musicians there, a violinist, a flutist, flutist and a clarinetist. And he wrote this quartet for the four of them. Can you imagine in a concentration camp, there's no nothing, just daily life is the most impossible thing that you can imagine. And yet, he had to create art because it's part of what made them human again, after the dehumanizing treatment that they all had that born. Music is powerful. And there's that old saying, with great power comes great responsibility. As a matter of fact, even Nietzsche, echoing that German tradition, the man who said, God is dead, believe in the Superman. And he said, without music, life would be a mistake. Really powerful statements about music. But there's a lot of danger. Let me tell you, one of the very first conductors, and this is how, as the conductor of your Alton Symphony Orchestra, I feel compelled to let you know how dangerous my job is. One of the first conductors, Jean-Baptiste Lully, and he was the conductor of one of the first orchestras called the 24 Violins of the King, or if you love it, Le 24 Violon du Roi. Say that five times real quick. And back in those days, they hadn't figured out, well, you carry a stick and you wave it and you can mark time that way. But back in those days, they did it the old-fashioned way, take a big old stick and pound it in the floor. With me! Sometimes rehearsals feel that way, don't they, Jerry? And so, but with this big, heavy cudgel. You see, back in those days, they didn't know what they knew about medicine and about antiseptic behavior. And so, as it turns out, Lully carried away to where music can only take you, he bashes himself in the foot, contracts gangrene, and 2 weeks later dies. This is a dangerous profession. I should also let you know that it's been almost 100 years, almost to the day, it'll be 100 years in May, that the premiere of Stravinsky's The Rite of Spring. It was so problematic, I mean, even to Diaghilev, who was the choreographer, when he asked Stravinsky, how long does this go on? To the very end, my dear. And of course, it happened to be one of these moments in Paris in 1913 where everything was ripe for a riot, and the music kindled that riot. The catcall started. Basically, it was between the people from the streets to the ladies of Ledoux who were saying, be quiet. No, this is... So believe it or not, there actually fist fights broke out. But, you know, it was one of those moments that was just ready for a riot. I would have loved to have been there. I would have hated to have been in the orchestra because I would want to see what was going on rather than play my part. But, of course, in subsequent performances, there were no riots. It's now one of the most beloved pieces in the repertoire. But just imagine that. Imagine that just making music, composing music, just doing music can be dangerous to you. Let me tell you a little bit about one of the pleasures that I've had, and let's bring this into a Unitarian Universalist perspective. I've been the choir director at Elliott Chapel for a long time now. As a matter of fact, I'm now the longest tenured employee of the church. I'm the grand old man. Wow. I've been going to, at the behest of my partner in crime, or I should say unindicted co-conspirator, Jan Chamberlain. And she said, you must come to the Unitarian Universalist Musicians Network Conference. You'll love it. You might not realize this, but I really am an introvert. I had to overcome it to do what I do, but I'm really an introvert. I don't like going out and meeting a whole lot of new people. I'm just not comfortable in that setting. And she says, you have to come. And so, of course, now these are like 300-400 of my closest friends. And one day, I'm sitting in my job, which has nothing to do with music. I get a call from Boston and a friend of mine I know from UUMN. Hi, Leon. Deb, great to hear from you. Well, what's going on? What do I owe this honor? Bill Sinkford had me call. Bill Sinkford's the past president of the Unitarian Universalist Association. And he wanted me to talk to you. Bill Sinkford knows who I am? What is this? Oh, we're going to put together a little commission. We'd like to put together a hymnal supplement. And Bill says he would like to get a new hymnal supplement that had both bright new hymns to enliven worship. Bill Sinkford knows who I am? Wow, okay. Well, who else are you planning to have for this? She went down the name. You can look at the beginning of the book and you can see, you know, the people underneath my name in the foreword. Those are the people she told me about. And I went, just to have the opportunity to sit and hang out with these people would be an honor and a privilege for me. So if you're going to put me in a room with them and we're going to make some work together, yes, I'm on. So, as they say, the rest is history. We made some amazing things, and of course, we went through some times. I don't have time to tell you all about it, but just hearing these people, two in specific. One, the Reverend Jason Shelton, who composed the hymn that we first sang today, and Ken Herman, who was then the president of the UUMN, and to hear them talk, it was like sophisticated thinking. They thought like chess players. They were always two or three moves ahead. I was in awe. I had so much to learn from these people listening to them talk. And I have to tell you how that wonderful now anthem of UU, Standing on the Side of Love, came into existence. And I was talking with your lead minister, and he was saying, yeah, we need to preserve these stories. Let me tell you, I've known Jason Shelton for a long time, and he is one of these, he's a marvel. He's like Mozart. You know, suddenly he gets an inspiration. An hour later, there's the piece completely written out. He's amazing. And he lives in Nashville, so he has facility with all these different forms of music. And he was the liturgist that year for General Assembly. He was in a meeting with Bill Sinkford, and it was the day President Bush announced the Defense of Marriage Act. And it had just come over the wires, and he was in this meeting with Bill Sinkford, and Bill Sinkford's assistant came in and said, the president has just announced the Defense of Marriage Act, and we really should take a stand immediately. Bill, what should we do? And Bill says, well, I think we have to stand on the side of love on this one. And I can imagine Jason sitting there going, and about an hour later, when he comes back and rejoins us next door for the rest of our meeting as we slog through 300 pieces, let me put it this way, 99% of which you would have to scrape off your shoe. And so we're there having lunch, and I noticed that Jason's miles away. And I asked him, Jason, what's going on? Jason, what's going on? Give it up, give it up. Something's going on. He said, he told me what I just told you. And he said, and I'm writing this piece. And we said, wow, is it that easy for you? Oh yeah, he went down to the piano and started playing. And I'm gonna do it the way he did. He's playing the chords as you hear them in the book. Standing on the side of love. Eject, we dare to, we are standing on the side of love. And he played it pretty much as it is in your hymnal. But with the words, the next day he had the words. Was truly amazing. So these are the people I get a chance to work with and hang out with. But you know, to a certain extent, him being on this commission was kind of dangerous because he was always one of us. And now a whole lot of composers throughout UU think that, well, he was on the commission to put all his songs into this hymnal. And he said, I shouldn't be on this thing because people are just going to say, no, 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 look at us all. We're all so independent. You know, no, you're not going to browbeat anyone into anything. But how he foresaw it is exactly how it is. I mean, he lost friends over this because they just thought he was advancing his own agenda. I mean, the truth of the matter is he is one of the best and the brightest songwriters of this generation. And I'm sorry, if you can't compete with that, don't compete with that, okay? Thank you so much. But anyway, after we rolled this out, there's a one piece that we have from an African composer, Tula Klezio. You might know the Ladysmith Black Mambazo. Joseph Shabalala is the conductor or the leader of that group. They're the group that was with Paul Simon on the Graceland album. And everyone says, oh, yeah, all right. So they had this wonderful Tula Klezio. And I had a friend who actually researched it. How did Ladysmith Black Mambazo do it? And so she duplicated everything. The hand motions, the little dance that Joseph Shabalala had taught them, and even mirrored by wearing the white tennis shoes that the poor people in Africa, you can tell, like in that song, Diamonds on the Soles of Her Shoes, you can tell people's state in life by what shoes they wear. So they were just done to a T. And they sing this for a break at the General Assembly, happened to be in St. Louis that year. And as soon as they finish their little break, they get up to sing to relieve the tension. And someone rushes to the procedural microphone. For those of you who don't realize that when someone comes to the procedural microphone, everything stops and they take over. And they wanted to decry the overt racism of that song. Can you believe that? We lost a teaching moment for people. But I learned, people come to church services pre-offended. It's one of those things. People don't have the trust that I know that Ken and Joy have here in this congregation, that I have in my congregation. When you're in front of 2,000-3,000 people, they're not going to be quite so trusting. And it's kicked off a whole new wave of trying to be sensitive to what's in the room throughout all of UU. For instance, we say we're welcoming to everyone. But can you imagine as we sing that wonderful hymn, we'll build a land where we'll bind up the broken, raising new cities out of devastation of old. And we all love to sing that song. How would that sound to a Native American? It'd be pretty off-putting. Can you imagine that? So I think that in UU, making music is dangerous. I don't know how you do it, Joy. Because you never know what's going to set something off. And I want to point out to you a little bit, this is not a criticism, but just to see how dangerous you are. The composer of How You Sing the Kids Out, Natalie Sleeth, she wrote that piece. It's May the Spirit of God Surround You Everywhere You May Go. And UU's came to her and said, oh, we love this piece. We use it all the time. It's all over the place. We just changed God. We changed it to love. She says, no. I wrote it this way, and you cannot change it. Now, some people just let that go and prefer to be, well, we sing it because we love it. And other people don't publish it. But I doubt that the Natalie Sleeth estate is as bad as Walt Disney. Walt Disney, you project something for a public, you know, they're on you, suing you like that the next day. But Natalie Sleeth is not that bad. So it's really amazing how we all can be so dangerous when we make music. But I'd like for you to not stop making music. Be aware of the danger. As a matter of fact, in the old days, if you were for civil rights, you had your songs. You had your songs. If you were trying to reform coal mining in America, you had your songs. If you were trying to promote fair wages for workers and unionism, you had your songs. These could be dangerous. People would hear the songs and they'd come after you. But it's really worth the songs. My voice teacher always says, Leon, you know, singing music is not a matter of life and death. It's much more important than that. And so just to let you know how we who serve in the UU congregations, I can almost say to a person, feel about it. I'm going to quote the Boston Conservatory, the head of the Boston Conservatory, talking to an incoming group of freshmen. And these are words I believe, and I know that most of my colleagues, all of my colleagues, as UU musicians feel. Frankly, ladies and gentlemen, I expect you not only to master music, I expect you to save the planet. If there is a future wave of wellness on this planet, of harmony, of peace, of an end to war, of mutual understanding, of equality, of fairness, I don't expect it will come from a government, a military force, or a corporation. I no longer even expect it to come from the religions of the world, which together seem to have brought us as much war as they have peace. If there is a future of peace for humankind, if there's to be an understanding of how these invisible internal things should fit together, I expect it will come from the artists, because that is what we do.